Today is August 7th, 2017. My name is Deborah Schwartz. I'm with the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library. And today I am interviewing musician Dori Kahler, also a member of the health food industry, husband, father, grandfather, and performer, and the man who just gave me my first musical intro. Dori, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to sit down and talk with the Mill Valley Historical Society.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks. Very nice intro.
Mississippi Blues.
Dori, you and I are friends.
Absolutely.
And it's a delight to interview a friend. And I'm really excited to have you here today. Finally, it's been a year coming for our interview, and so much has happened in that year, musically and with
That's
the community,
right.
So I'm really glad it took a while. To begin our interview, I'd love to, people around Mill Valley know that you're a musician and have seen you perform a lot, but perhaps they don't know that much about what brought you to Mill Valley, so this is our opportunity to learn a bit about you and your family. And we'll start with some contextual information first. If you could just tell me about your name, tell me about your people, where your ancestors or where your relatives came from, and what brought you to Mill Valley.
Well, I'd be happy to. Deborah, it's such a humbling honor and privilege to be asked to do an interview like this for little old me. I've been here pretty much steady since the early 1970s in California, Northern California. I grew up in the Hudson River Valley, about 40, 50 miles north of New York City. My family was all from New York. I guess my great-grandparents came over from Eastern Europe. I think I have most of Eastern Europe in my ancestry from one great-grandparent or another. So all of my grandparents were actually born in this country. So they got out fairly early, and they were all here by the 1880s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, on my father's side, they were involved in the theater, actually. They were, I have a great-grandmother who was part of a family that was pretty much the Barrymores of the Yiddish-Jewish theater at the turn of the century. There's a family, the Tomaszewskis. Boris and his family pretty much started many, many things that we take for granted in the entertainment industry. Many, 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 many people started by working with him on the Lower East Side.
And was this your great-grandfather, your grandfather?
This is my great, I guess a great-great-uncle, great-uncle perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandmother was in the theater with him, and it was his sister.
Do you remember your great-grandmother's name?
Mary.
Mary.
Nice Jewish name.
Mary
Tomaszewski.
Oh, Tomaszewski.
And actually, her husband, Leon Epstein, was the treasurer for the theater.
Oh, so it's in your blood for realsy.
I come by it, like, really honestly, yes.
Yes, this is a family.
It was a small step.
Yeah, so
it's kind of there.
So near New York, and you come from a Jewish family.
Absolutely. Yes. Russian, Romanian, Czechoslovakian, Hungarian. Like I say, most of Eastern Europe, you know, I was told as a child that they were from, you know, someplace outside of it that was, I think, part of Ukraine or, Belarus now. And another thing that was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that's probably part of Poland now. And then I mm-hmm. had other relatives that were from Moscow. And it's a wide range of the whole Eastern Europe.
Do you remember the names of both sides? Just if you don't, that's fine.
Oh, God. There were Tomaszewskis and Berliners and Kelmans and Banners were my four grandparents' names.
And then how about your parents? Tell me a little bit about your parents, starting with their names, when they were born and where they were born.
My mother was Sandra Kahler. Was born in February 6th of 1928. My father was Frederick Kahler. I guess my mother was Sandra Kelman.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't Kahler yet. Not at birth. And my father was Frederick Kahler. He was born on our Armistice Day, November 11th, 1925.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the youngest daughter of two sisters in her family. Father was also the youngest. He was the baby boy, and he had two older sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And so
they were born in New York as well?
They were both born in Brooklyn, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes. Huh. What an interesting life they must have had there in the
community. Yes, they did. You know, it was certainly culturally active, mm-hmm, in the time they were there growing up in the Depression years, you know. And I think my father felt the Depression more than my mother did in his family. And actually, my father's father, talking about coming by it, honestly, my father's father, who was, you know, obviously in the Tomaszewski family, was actually a conductor and a pianist and a orchestral arranger, played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Played the Mighty Wurlitzer in the silent movies in the 20s, and was actually part of the WPA work, Mercury Theater work project, worked with Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten, and was one of the founding members of BMI, the Copyright Musical Agency Group, and died young, died at the New York World's Fair in 1939, so I never got to meet him.
He died at the fair?
Had a heart attack, very young. It's unfortunate, but so I never got to meet him. But obviously, I got the bug pretty directly from him.
You did. Mm-hmm.
My father was a child prodigy on the trumpet, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But his father wouldn't allow any of his children to go into music more seriously because you couldn't make a living doing that.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. So you're from the East Coast, but we're here on the West Coast here. We're sitting in California.
Good point. Yes, let me say right now that I think the East Coast is a fantastic place, and it's a wonderful place to be from. Great place to be from. But when I was about, I don't know, about 12 or 13 years old, it was the mid-60s, and I had an aunt and uncle and a cousin who was about my age that were going to come to Northern California for Easter vacation. Spring break, and I was asked if I wanted to accompany them, and I said, "Are you kidding? Absolutely, you know." And I was already listening to the music that was had. I was already aware of what was going on in San Francisco musically,
mm-hmm,
and I was into those bands and it was the happenings.
And you were playing already?
I was playing already. You know, I was. I really, you know, singing. I don't remember breathing without singing. I mean, I was singing and writing songs and. As a child all my life. But I was in chorus in the fourth grade. I took up trombone in the fourth or fifth grade. I switched over to bass guitar because I could read bass clef like when I was about in the seventh grade. And so, I mean, I switched over to guitar. I played guitar from then on, I guess. But I really didn't switch over to guitar until I was about 16. But
mm-hmm.
So I was very involved. I was totally involved and interested and absorbed and listening to music is really all I really ever paid attention to.
Mm-hmm. What kind of student were you? Good in band?
Okay. I was an okay student.
There were
so many other things that were more important.
Could be distracted. The music was really popping in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, you know, the music got me out of high school early, actually. I graduated early because I had so many music and humanities and arts credits that I could have gotten out a year early. I wasn't allowed that. I got out a half year early.
You describe yourself sort of sponge-like, like you couldn't, voracious appetite for anything. Is that how we would describe
yourself? I seem to be pretty receptive. I seem to have a propensity for absorbing my surroundings and adapting to them fairly quickly and getting a whole lot of out of them, I guess, without taking advantage of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People all my life have always... It just opened up to me. People tell me their life stories. I've never met them before.
Yeah.
When I was hitchhiking around the country, people would just naturally open up to me, and I don't know why. You know.
Do you think, as a songwriter, that's impacted your writing?
Oh, absolutely.
The stories that you hear along the way.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, when you're writing a song, you're basing it on some sort of experience, and then as you become more experienced of a songwriter, you're thinking about, you know, you're basically harvesting what you've taken in,
mm-hmm,
and trying to express it in a certain way. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hitchhike, get in a car, and while you're riding with some stranger say to yourself, this would be a good song?
Many is the time and situation that have been duly noted and may be used and employed in certain songs and certain aspects.
Uh-huh.
Because I had many adventures when I was at that age traveling and doing all that.
So when you came with your relatives over to Northern California, mm-hmm. where what part of Northern California did you come to?
San Francisco.
You came to San Francisco?
We came to San Francisco. It was 1969. It was
relatives in 1969 to San Francisco. Uh-huh.
And I was
how fortuitous.
14. And I was already, you know, into the music scene, kind of knew what was going on. And actually, I think the Jefferson Airplane were probably my favorite band at that point. Uh-huh. So, and my cousin and my aunt and uncle were from Long Island, so they were a little more conventional, straighter. He was kind of a jock, and you know, while he was hanging around, we stayed at the Jack Tar Hotel, which was Cathedral Hill right there on Van Ness, and right across from Tommy's Joint.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, while he was kind of hanging out at the hotel trying to pick up chicks at the pool, I was all over San Francisco. I was walking down, walking up Tate Street, going to Hippie Hill, you know, hitchhiking, you know, just roaming around as much as I could, at, you know.
You're just 14, age. Though.
What's your point? Remember, you know, I grew up an hour north of New York City, and my parents, being from New York City, basically had an image of New York City as the place that they'd grown up in 30 years ago, where you could basically take the train and take the subway any place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father was from down by Coney Island, and, you know, he would go to the doctor's office, which was in Rockefeller Center at Radio City in that area. So he'd take a 90-minute subway ride by himself when he was 7, 8. So my parents thought nothing of letting us go down to the Fillmore East to see a concert, just go to see music or march in a Vietnam rally or whatever it was. So came out here, that was my perception of how things are done. You just do them.
And what did you see on your little sojourn out in San Francisco at 14 years old in 1969?
You know, like I said, you know, Hate Street in 1969 was not a very nice place. A lot of the, you know, speed had already happened. It was mostly speed freaks. A lot of the buildings and storefronts were boarded up. It was pretty funky on Hate Street itself. Hippie mm-hmm. Hill was happening.
Where's Hippie Hill exactly?
Hippie Hill is, you know, if you walk Hate Street and you cross Danion and you go into the park
mm-hmm.
and you go under the little tunnel and kind of before you get to the carousel area, over to the right, there's just this very slow incline, grassy hillside. And that was Hippie Hill. And there were people, hippies, running around there, throwing frisbees and just hanging out. And, you know, somebody said Frank Zappa was there when I was there, but I don't know if that was true or not. And, I just roamed around. You know, I walked up Hate Street, and they, you know, the lower, you know, Hate from Market to Masonic was the Fillmore District. You know, it was basically a black ghetto as much as they had one out here, and it was pretty skeezy looking. Again, I had grown up, you know, in my early teens going to Manhattan all the time in New York without any parental supervision, so I didn't really think much of it, you know. And so yeah, Hippie Hill, and then I came back down and, you know, went the wrong way on the Ashbury and ended up on Ashbury Heights, and then ended up hitchhiking back down to Market Street, and you know, some people picked me up in a Volkswagen bug and just basically was having a good time. And I was going back to the Jack Tar to reconnoiter, and some hippie with hair down to here, like almost to his shoulders, hit me up for some spare change. He said, hey, I'm trying to get some money. I'm the Grateful Dead are playing at the Avalon tonight. And I was like, the Avalon Ballroom was about a block and a half away from our hotel. And so I said, well, Avalon Ballroom, Grateful Dead, I have certainly heard of them. I don't know their music that well. I should go. We should go.
And you said to the hippie kid, let's go?
No, I said to myself. You know, I gave him whatever I had. And Nicole,
you didn't go with him, you just said.
Did not go with
him.
I'm
going.
I didn't say, can I go? No, because I'm still a good little boy. I'm 14. I wanted to bring my cousin. Uh-huh. I wanted to turn him onto it. And you know, I did pop by the Avalon to check it out because it was only a block and a half away. And you needed parental permission. You needed some adult to say it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and asked my uncle Marvin. was in the, he was a furrier in the textile biz. And I asked him if it was okay, if we could go. And he said, whatever. And he walked it, and he was going to go to sleep at, you know, it's like 8 when he's walking us down there, and he was going to go to sleep at like 8:05. You know? And he walked us down there, and he basically paid the, I think it was $5 each, you know, paid the $5 each and said, it's okay with me for them to go in here. And just left us there. And the Avalon Ballroom, I don't know if you ever got to go there. Avalon Ballroom was, if the entrance was on Sutter Street, not kind of where the Regency is now on Van Ness. And, you know, there's a little ticket office, box office. And then you went up these little stairs to the ballroom itself. And the ballroom, you know, there was a light show on the wall on three sides, screens and a light show on three sides. Fillmore East only had the one screen behind the stage. And it was this huge open space with no seats. And up at the very back, upstairs in the balcony, was a Chinese restaurant. And, you know, we're these two 14-year-olds, and suddenly we're, like, in the middle of this incredible melee of just extremely wild, extremely crazy, extremely free people, you know. And Flying Burrito Brothers with Graham Parsons was one of the opening acts. You know, like, in their nudie Western suits, the full-on Burrito Brothers, which was... pretty, I wasn't that into country. I was kind of down on Dylan and the Birds for going that way at that point, but I knew who the Burrito Brothers were, and I was glad to see them. And then I was at a Grateful Dead concert the first time I was out here, and that just blew me away. And then while we were staying in San Francisco, we were in San Francisco, we were in Yosemite, and we were in Carmel. Those were the three places
beautiful places to visit.
And so naturally we're in San Francisco, and it's the end of March, early April, so it's... it's springtime, and back east it's winter still, and everything's gray. You come out here, it's springtime, and the hills are all that emerald green. You know, everything is just vibrant and alive, and, you know, and San Francisco, because of the wind, San Francisco still is a very clean city, air-wise, compared, certainly in the late 60s, compared to anything on the eastern seaboard. And so we said, well, we went to Muir Woods, and you know, so we drove. I remember that we drove through the Waldo Tunnel. It was just when they were building, replacing the old Redwood Causeway that went across Richardson Bay. Mm-hmm. Not that I knew that at the time, because I just remember we went through the tunnel and then it just was construction all the way down to Tam Junction. And we drove out to Mill Valley, winding through these incredible velvet green hills and these eucalyptus groves. And which the vegetation is so different here from the East Coast. And so you're looking at all of these exotic plants, really, as you're driving along. And I remember... and again, remember, it's 1969, so the Summer of Love had already happened 2 years ago. I was really into what was going on there, you know. Already gotten high, already taken LSD, already taken anything I'd got my hands on.
At 14?
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. I think we're probably the first class that came into high school, into our high school, doing everything. Mm-hmm. Of course, that year, 68, 69, everybody, regardless of age, that's sort of when everybody turned on, you know. I speak to everybody was 3 years older than me in high school. We're turning on that year. And I speak to other people who were in college. But that was kind of when it really spread out. So, yeah, I was into what was going on. And I'm seeing these people just on the side of the road. Like, you know, if you're walking the Dipsy and you come down and you're coming down towards Muir Woods. And there's these people just hanging out looking like hippies with flutes and strange clothing on. And just kind of looking, well, it's twinkling their eye. I remember that. It's like the first thing I remember really of driving through the hills around Mill Valley. And we went to Muir Woods and we hiked a ways up in. My cousin was not into hiking any further. I'm like, hey, because the next place we were going was Stinson Beach. I said, well, look, this says here this trail goes to Stinson. We'll go to Stinson and we'll call your parents from Stinson, you know, not realizing it's, you know, 5-6 miles. And, you know, they'd probably be freaking out by then. But we got about halfway up, and we were stopping at a rest area, and some woman hiker came by and told us that it was a long trip, and he said, no way. We went back down, and I would have gladly hiked over there. And so then we went to Stinson. It was, you know, warm enough, and it was really my first experience with the Pacific Ocean. So I rolled my elephant bell bottoms up as far as I could, and waded out into the Pacific Ocean at Stinson and turned around and looked up at Tam, at Mount Tam from Stinson, all vibrant and green and just gorgeous looking. And I kind of looked at him and went, yeah, this is more like it. I didn't know this is what I had in mind, but this is what I had in mind. This suits me just fine. I like this place, you know. And so that was, you know, my experiences. Then we went to Yosemite and buzzed around there. And then we drove all the way through Fresno, all the way down to actually went to San Simeon. So we went Big Sur, stopped at Nepenthe and the Phoenix and hung out. And
got your California tour.
Got a nice NorCal tour.
Yeah. How interesting to hear you describe this first impression, your first visit. Because, and I don't want to be I don't want to ruin the what will come, but the fact is, this is a bit of foreshadowing, because as we're going to get to it, you just created a music video, and Bobby Weir's in it, and it's all about Tam.
Maria Muldaur and many other folks.
And many other performers. And so it's really nice to hear what an impact this area had on you right from the beginning, and how that impact has lasted, how the whatever touched you then has touched you for life. But we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yes, I have often been described as touched. A little touched, yeah.
So when is it that you finally moved here?
Well, I was 69. I got out of high school early in 72, came out here. Actually, it was in Southern California. Tried to get up here to Davenport, where a friend of mine was living in a school bus, but didn't quite make it that time. And then my parents begged me to go to college, said they would pay for it. And so I went to Hobart and William Smith College in Western New York State, out in the Finger Lakes region, for a year. Hitchhiked all over that area. I was basically playing all the coffee houses from Buffalo to Boston while I was in college.
What kind of music were you playing?
I was transitioning. Well, I didn't have a car, and I couldn't tote around an electric guitar or a bass or anything, so I was playing acoustic. Mm-hmm. I had just learned how to flat pick, so I just learned how to finger pick. So I was playing, I just learned how to play slide around about that time. So I was doing more different folk, folk country, bluegrass, blues, you know, more acoustic idioms, as it were.
Do you remember a single song? Can you give me a little snippet of something you would have played then?
Mm. Well, I was real into Leo Kottke. It was a finger-picking monster at the time. Playing that, I was learning how to flat pick. I was playing bluegrass for the first time, probably a little bit, learning some fiddle tunes, and playing slide in a little folk group. I learned my first Little Feet tune, Willin, playing slide in a.
How's that song go, Willin?
Just a tiny bit.
Tiny bit.
I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchapi to Tonopah. I've driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. Driven in the back row so I wouldn't get away.
I remember that song. That's a good one. That helps put me there with you. I'm glad you played that.
I've always been a musical sponge. I love music. I love playing it. I seem to have some sort of faculty for hearing something and being able to reproduce it. And around then, I've always been extremely gregarious, and I've always wanted to be everybody's friend and be part of every social group and basically interact with everyone and have some common denominator with whoever I run into. And in music, back probably that year, I decided I was just going to work on learning pretty much every style of music I could, so I could communicate and play music with whoever I happen to run into.
So music is the way that you connect with your community?
Absolutely.
Is that how you would describe it?
It's my best way of connecting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yeah, about that time I learned to play all these different instruments. And about halfway through that school year, I was asked to leave that school, and because they needed some money from somebody, so I took a couple loans out and finished the school year. But since I knew I was, you know, I said to my parents, thank you very much. Now I've gone, I went to college like you wanted me to for a year, and now I'm moving to California to play music, basically. And I came out of spring break, so this would have been late winter, early spring 1973. A couple of my friends at college were going on a skiing trip. There were plenty of entitled people at Hobart and William Smith College. It was sort of a safety school for Ivy Leaguers, you know, that didn't have the grades. Mm-hmm. There was enough ivy on the walls to be respectable enough. Mm-hmm. I think most of these people were called preppies in a year or two or after
back
that.
Back then, yes.
You know, just starting to become preppy. You know. A couple guys were going to Taos to go skiing for spring break. I said, well, that's 3/4 of the way. I'll catch a ride with them. So I caught a ride with them, hitchhiked the rest of the way from Taos, New Mexico, out here.
And this is back to San Francisco area.
Yeah. Had some friends in San Francisco, had a bunch of names on pieces of paper of friends of friends in various places. I had one classmate of mine was living in San Rafael. I had a name of somebody in Point Reyes Station. I had the name of somebody in Westport, California as well. I had some friends in Santa Cruz.
So you had contacts. And did you begin playing with bands in this area right away when you arrived?
Pretty much.
How are some of the people that you've played with in this? I mean, I've interviewed a fair number of musicians, and it seems to me there's a pretty cozy group, especially in Mill Valley, but in San Francisco as well. It seems like many of them have played with each other. How about?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, people in Mill Valley, obviously, I've been here for a long time, so I've played with pretty much everybody. I do a lot of work with Lauren Rowan, sometimes with Chris Rowan. I've done stuff with Audie DeLone, you know, I've done stuff with some of the more loop. I mean, in the video, Bob Ware joined us for that, as did Maria Muldaur, mm-hmm. who I play with a bunch within the bluegrass community. And, you know, in the past, I've had contact with people like Marty Balin and Bill Champlin. And, you know, way, way back then when I was about 19, I did get a chance to play with Jerry Garcia once. Mm-hmm. I worked for Bill Graham for about a dozen years in the 80s, early 90s. So,
what'd you do with him?
Mostly security, mm-hmm. backstage stuff, security mm-hmm. and production. Mm-hmm. Mostly security. I was running the security crews. I was a blue coat, is what it's called.
Hard to imagine you that now.
That's good.
How was it? So here you are. You moved to Mill Valley directly in the...
No, when I came out, I mean, so I was here in that spring and mm-hmm. had some amazing experiences, like, you know, going backstage at one of the first Olden in the Way shows at Lion's Share, which is actually where I met Lauren, and it's where I got to meet Jerry and Vassar Clements and a lot of people mm-hmm. and Peter.
That was in San Rafael?
That was in San Rafael in the mm-hmm. Miracle Mall. You know. Mm-hmm. I was, if you want to, I mean, the Bill Champlin story is, so I'm here, I spend the night with my classmate who's in San Rafael, but he's not feeling well, so I said, well, I'll just hitchhike out to Point Reyes Station. I have a name on a piece of paper of somebody in Point Reyes Station. I'll go see who what that's all about. And so I'm hitchhiking through San Rafael and San Anselmo. I'm on Center, and I'm at about where Lansdale Station is, which is where David Kessner had the church recording studio, just up the hill from there. Just about a half a block from there. I'm hitchhiking in this beat-up old, like, 1960 Mercury Comet. Pulls up to pick me up, and there's this, you know, grungy old looking hippie guy with long hair and a long beard, kind of a tall, skinny guy, picks me up, and like three cars pull up right behind him, and I said, no, we want to pick up the hitchhiker. No, we want to be there. They were talking, and they were talking about music, and they, you know, they obviously, the upshot of it was that the first one who stopped was Bill Champlin. Sons of Champlin, mm-hmm. local boy, and they mm-hmm. were just—they were recording "Welcome to the Dance," mm-hmm. the album they were recording at the time at the church. And he lived in Inverness, and he was heading home. He's picking up the hitchhiker, and, you know, so I you know, I kind of knew who the Chance. I mean, the Suns weren't really a big band in the East Coast at that point. They really didn't.
Very big here.
Super big, huge here. Mm-hmm. But they, but I heard of them. I'd seen their names on the Fillmore posters and the handbills and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I was aware that they were part of the scene. So it's, he's talking to me and we were talking. And just like everyone I ever met in Northern California who was a musician at that time had amazing pop. Just cartoon, get you just cartoon land. Psychedelic color pot. I don't know what these guys had on it. It was a lot better than anything, almost anything I'd ever gotten back east of Japan. So we're getting high and driving out. It's a long drive, you know.
Yes.
And I'm asking him about the Suns and, you know, what's going on with that and how we do, how. And I said, how would you describe the Suns? And he said, well, we're kind of a cross between, you know, James Brown and the Grateful Dead. You know, and he said, my favorite vocalist is Lou Rawls, you know, but we are definitely, you know, cosmic San Francisco scene band, which I said, well, that sounds awesome. I definitely have to check you guys out, you know, when I get a chance. And told him I was a musician. I was planning to move out to be a musician, and that was my thing. And he gave me some advice. He said, you know, and this is 1973, when every other person wasn't from the East Coast. You know, when I first came out here, you know, you had to like blend in. I had to learn how to say water and quarter and far out and for sure. All my vowels had to flatten just to blend in. You know? But Bill Champlin said, you know, people who come out from the East Coast, they tend to be, you know, a little aggressive and pushy when they come out. And it's mellower out here. You have to come off. He said, you have to come off. You have to just kind of come off much mellower. But don't stop pushing. That was his advice to me. He said, don't slow down. But of course, I didn't take his advice. I got totally mellow and didn't drive, I suppose. But he drops me off in Point Reyes Station. You know, he invited me to come over to his house, but I was on a mission with this piece of paper I had. So he dropped me off. He turned off to Inverness, and I walked into Point Reyes Station, which, you know, in the rain in 1973, which the same as it is now, it looks like the James Gang could ride on in horses and rob the local bank or whatever. And I was really high. And so I was wandering around Point Reyes Station late in the afternoon, looking at the wrong piece of paper with the wrong person's name and not really connecting. I went to the local bookstore with just a free box in front of it and stuff, and just where the person was supposed to be, but I was asking for the wrong name, and I was like, it's getting dark out here and it's like wintertime and it's kind of misty. I should just turn around and go back to my friends and see if I can stay there another night. And then the VW bus picked me up heading back south to Olema to get back to Sir Francis Drake. And we rode for a little bit and the fella Herbie Gupta, who picked me up, Herbie and Beverly, riding along. And he was a drummer in a band. And he said, we're driving along for a while, and he said, you don't really have a place to stay tonight, do you? And I said, well, no, not really. He said, I'll tell you what, we stop at Olema, go back to Point Reyes, and go to 55 Manana Way. That's where I live. And, you know, just knock on the door and tell them that, you know, I said you could stay there. We're going to Fairfax. They actually worked at the Good Earth doing baking and stuff. And so I did that. And it turns out it was a band that lived there. Most of the people were musicians. It was at Steve Hurton's house and Scott Traeger and Jeff Tanger, great songwriter. Most of these people were from the East Coast originally, but they were living in, and they had a band called Manana Way. And they had a gig at a place called Mr. Lee's, which was this funky little bar, kind of, you know, there used to be that place right before you cross the causeway where there was always like Redwood Burrow, and there was this little shack in the middle of it. Well, that was the last standing building of the original Marin City business district. And there was an old black guy named Mr. Lee who had a bar there. And so literally the first week I was in California, I had a gig playing bass with this band from Point Reyes Station.
So. Did you feel at that time that you things had, well, that you were meant to be where you were? Did you have a sense?
Well, if I hadn't thought it before, things were kind of working out for me here, you know? It was like, whoa, this is, I can't believe this, you know? I definitely felt that way. You know, it was fulfilling, you know, all of my expectations as far as I was concerned.
Yeah. So you went on to have a career in music then?
I did the best I could.
Yep.
To have a career in music.
Yes. And raise your family here in Mill Valley.
You know, I lived in Santa Cruz for the better part of 9 years. First couple of years, I bounced back and forth between there and here.
Mm-hmm.
And left for the Caribbean for a while. And then the early 80s, came back to San Francisco. And then in the later 80s, as kids were coming along, we moved back up to Marin.
Some people may know your wife, Debbie, from when she worked as a manager.
Deborah Collar, absolutely. Yes. She's way more famous than I am in this town. She was taking care of everybody's health and medical needs for a long, long time.
At Pharmaca.
She was at Whole Foods for about 6.5 years down there on Miller before mm-hmm. Pharmaca.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was the manager of Pharmaca and opened that and worked there for 11
years. Time.
Yeah.
Right. So let's go forward a little bit. We're now, you're here, you're raising your children in Mill Valley. Kids, music.
Yes, my son Logan and my other son Evan. Both TAM grads. I think one graduated in 04 and one graduated in 06.
Mm-hmm. And you're playing your music and you're traveling around. Actually, I met you because my sister plays with Toby Gray in Santa Cruz.
It's all happened because of Jan.
Because
thank you, Jan.
We should be acquainted. And because you're a bit of a traveling minstrel.
I do get around.
You get around and you go from place to place. But you, in your own unique and wonderful way, have done some things with our music community in this last year that has basically, I would say, it punctuates your connection to Mount Tam.
Absolutely.
And your love of history. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, sure. You know, as long as I've lived in Mill Valley, and we've been in Mill Valley since 1990, you know, I have been involved with many, many different, you know, community events. I wasn't just playing at the Sweetwater or whatever. You know, I've had a lot to do with raising money for Kiddo. I've played at Little League things. I've played, you know, like I said, Kiddo. I've been in the Mill Valley Memorial Day Parade for one nonprofit or another. The most recent one, of course, was for the Historical Society with the Millbillies, but
Dory Collar and the Millbillies.
I've definitely
playing.
Tried to get as involved, you know, and share with what I have, which I think is mostly music,
mm-hmm.
with the community. And in that same respect, when I was younger, I'd done a lot of aside from music, had done acting and performance stuff, and had a taste for theater. And then I worked for Bill Graham behind the scenes for those years. And in the late '90s, I was at the Mountain Play and asked if they needed anybody, and ended up running security and cleanup and running a whole restoration crew up there on the mountain at the Cushing Theater for about 15 years.
That's quite a long time to be involved with the theater.
Yeah, and I just stopped doing that a year or two ago,
mm-hmm.
Just to leave space for other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a very, very strong feeling. I've always had a very, very strong interest in history and where things come from. And obviously I spent a lot of time on the mountain. Involved with the Mountain Play, and I'd, you know, be there from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every show before and after. So I had a strong feeling for that place.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was really music that took me into this later thing. I had a little bluegrass riff it was obviously a bluegrass riff, and it was a good riff. And I had sort of a stock riff that I really hadn't used for anything. And I said, I should write a bluegrass song. And I said, well, what do you write bluegrass songs about? Drowning your girlfriend in the river, murder, death, mom, prison, trains. I'll write a song about the old railroad grade. And, you know, because I thought, there's all these place names, you know. I give back a little to the mountain by doing it. And I spent about 25 minutes on Wikipedia and a couple other websites, Googled it, and got all I needed. There was even a death. So it really made it a bluegrass song.
A dramatic death.
Death. So that helped. Or, you know, a train wreck really helped for a bluegrass song. You got to have something like that going on. And that's what inspired me to write that song. I wrote this song called The Old Railroad Grade. And we had already met through your sister, and I just took a little video of me on my phone playing it and sent that to you, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, I heard that song poorly recorded the video, you know, from down below. So it was all Chin. And you sang that song. And I thought, wow, that's a great song. And showed it to a good friend of mine, Gary Yost, the filmmaker. And we asked, I asked if you might bring in some other performers to play the song. Gary and I came over after you practiced for about an hour, I believe.
Yeah, we hadn't practiced for more than an hour at that point.
Yes, and
we're just about ready.
Gary made a film of it, and now we have this beautiful film, the old railroad grade, which he infused with footage from the old scenic railway.
Gary is a remarkable man. You know, he's, we were just making a better, you know, audio version for you to bring to the Historical Society, and you know, you asked me if it was okay if Gary came by and joined us just to hang out, and I was like, sure. You know, Gary with, you know, held his cell phone and did a video on one side and held his cell phone on his video and did it another side and basically got a two camera shoot. And after we did it, he said he was really impressed with it. And he said, if you can mix this down and give it to me tonight, you'll have a video in the morning, which is completely unheard of. Of course, I said yes. I was like,
well, you don't know Gary.
Okay.
He goes down the rabbit hole and comes up with something.
It's just amazing. You know, and while he was there, he said, God, it'd be great if you could write an anthem for the restoration of the West Peak. It's what we're working on right now. And
Gary Yost is very much involved in trying to get the West Peak cleared from the debris and the material and the cement that was left there after World War II by the U.S. Army.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, they got the barracks down, you know, 25, 30 years ago, but they just left it there. There's this mess up there in the middle of this gorgeous park. We really, you know, needs to be restored. And you know, the way my brain works is if somebody makes a suggestion, you know, I had the chorus of the song written almost instantly, you know, and then I called him back and said, hey, you know, I think I could do this, you know. And Gary and I spent the next 6 months kind of working on it because it was winter weather. You know, I went up in probably December of last year, spent the day up there with him. I got the $15 tour because I was going to write a song. He showed me all these amazing places, and that completed the feelings I had for what I thought I would be writing about. You know, he had a specific idea in mind of what kind of a song he wanted it to be, and then he said anthem. I said, you mean like Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, I'm playing a 12-string kind of anthem. He said, yeah. I said, okay, I've got a 12-string, I could do that. Also, I grew up in the Hudson River Valley, so I was involved at around that same age. I came out to California, and a little before, I helped Pete Seeger raise the funds to get the Sloop Clearwater built, which was pretty much the beginning of the ecology movement. Pete canoeing with his buddies and seeing how awful the Hudson River looked like, and saying we ought to do something about it. Let's hold a bunch of concerts down by the water so people can see. Pretty much that. So I was involved with that. I grew up in a place where Pete Seeger was. Lee Hayes of the Weavers lived in my hometown. So I had some exposure to that. So when Gary said that's what he was looking for, I was like, I think I know that.
I
can do that.
It's a wonder. I should think it's amazing to be able to love something so much like music and then use it as a tool, a powerful effect for change.
God, that is, it's such a, I wouldn't call it a gift. It's such a present.
You know? Privilege.
Yeah, privilege just to be able to give back and use whatever talents you have to participate in making, you know, your local environment and the world a better place it's certainly what my music is always is all about. I've written a lot of songs about the situations in politics and how things are and how things could be. So
yes, your song, you wrote Silent Spring, another beautiful song.
That's right. Yes. It's a song I got a platinum award for the 40th anniversary Earth Day celebrations in Marin County. I was awarded something for that.
Do you find that people are really looking for the opportunity to contribute in that way musically? I mean, when you wrote the song the way it's supposed to be, to anthem, you've got some local musicians there, and
that
aren't that easy to engage, apart from their professional work. But
How hard was it for you to enlist their help with your...
Well, you know, Deborah, from where we're sitting, I can look to my right and look at this mountain, Mount Tamalpais. And if you've had any experience on that mountain, the energy of that mountain and how good it makes you feel, you know, it certainly makes you an environmentalist right off the bat. And the majority of the musicians, at least that I choose to work with and know and have met as well, really, most musicians I know have jumped at the opportunity to give back in such a way and help something like that. It was, you know, do I think that any of those people would have done this just for me? You know, I'm just a guy who plays guitar. I'm just a musician. I've sacrificed whatever commercial fame I wanted for the environment I live in. And that's more important to me than a career. And, they didn't do it because of me. They didn't do it because of Gary. They did it because of that mountain. And anything that could make that better and improve that and make things in general for everyone, posterity better. That's something, you know, in addition to Bob Ware and Maria Muldaur and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and we also had, you know, Matt Jaffe and Carolyn Skye. We had, you know, Josh Zucker, the Zucker family, who lived in Mill Valley for a long time. We had Lauren Rowan. We had Susan Zielinski, who everybody's probably seen perform at the Mountain Play. Amazing singer, woman with amazing voice, gives a lot of herself. And, you know, in addition to that, in the audience, you know, there was a whole string. There was Pat Campbell and John Mitgard, who plays with Danny Glick, and who else was there? Jim Strand was there. Kid Echo, great violinist, was there. There were all these musicians who just came up to be part of the chorus for the day.
Mm-hmm. As well as a lot of hikers.
And a lot of hikers.
And the Rangers.
Had the Rangers.
Friends.
Had a whole lot of people. But I'm just talking about the musicians that just jumped at an opportunity to be able to do something like that. You know, it's what we look for. I mean, it's something we all... most of us want to do. We don't have an opportunity. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's a real honor to be
for using your gift to help get the attention.
My pleasure.
Yes. When you think about the life that you've lived here in Mill Valley, do you see changes now in our community? Do you think it's different?
Gosh,
do you think it's...
You think it's changed much? Gosh, Deborah, I don't know. You know, Well, there's that word entitlement, you know, that seems to come up a lot. People seem to act like they're really entitled to be here. When I first was here, the depot was still just a little magazine kiosk at a bus station. You know, the buses turned around there and Lytton Plaza and kept around. And, you know, it was obvious that people had made a conscious choice to live, you know, kind of a little outside the rat race by living here. Certainly in the early 70s, Marin County, to me, it seemed like most of that sort of hard-driving, trendy status thing was maybe just happening in Sausalito, maybe a neighborhood or two in Ross or Canfield, but it wasn't the whole county. And over the years, I've seen it spread, you know, north up the 101 corridor and west and everywhere else and be pervasive, you know. But certainly, I think the difference is people moved here, lived here because of a certain pace and a certain easygoingness and a certain, I wouldn't say lack of drive, but a certain desire to live another way. And, you know, a lot of the political action and environmental stuff that happened in Marin County in the 70s, like everywhere else, I mean, we worked really hard, you know, in the 60s, they worked really hard to keep Caltrans from building, you know, a freeway out to West Marin and a convention center at Rodeo Beach and have something just plowing through there. And there was a lot of work in the 70s to try to maintain a green belt around the populated areas and just concentrate in the populated areas. You know, nobody was thinking in 1975 or whenever that was happening, hey, let's really limit the growth here so the real estate will be more valuable in 10 years. That just was... you know, I shouldn't say nobody. There was probably some twisted person thinking that, but nobody was really thinking that in all of those movements and all of those efforts and initiatives. The whole point was to make it a better place to live, and better meant environmentally, you know, ecologically better place to live, not higher priced and fancier and more exclusive place to live in. Certainly you've seen that. And it's endemic of our society. You know, my time living in Mill Valley since 1990 has been on the wrong side of the freeway. I live over in Strawberry in one of those little stucco houses at the bottom of the valley under Tiburon Boulevard, you know, that they built for the shipyard workers in the 40s. And, you know, it was sort of like the wrong side of the tracks. And a few years ago, I noticed right around Labor Day when school started that the streets, all the major arteries in this town got impacted with that red clay we keep trying to dig out of our garden. It just became impassable. And you can't just blame that on the people in Mill Valley. It's a lifestyle, you know. Apparently, there was an edict that suddenly came out that no child can walk anywhere or take their bikes anywhere. And I think that Mill Valley, you know, is suffering from that. You know, and that's more of a consciousness thing of a community and a general feeling that the world is unsafe out there for whatever reason. It's not just Mill Valley's fault. I mean, you know, Tiburon certainly has the same sort of congestion with that one artery, you know, with their artery going down Tiburon Boulevard. Miraculously, they've started paying for shuttles for the kids, and they're actually dealing with that traffic a little bit. But so it's changed. I think when you make an area exclusive with close proximity to the financial centers of San Francisco, more people are going to want to live here. There's no reason that Mill Valley should be more expensive than San Anselmo. It's a beautiful little town with a seminary. But it is because it's closer to the freeway, it's closer to the city. So, yeah, I mean, it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah, well, the state is more crowded in general.
We've talked about some of the more challenging changes that have occurred in Mill Valley. But, Dori, can you tell me about some of the things that have changed for the positive in our community, in our town?
Well, you know, we are still such an artistic community, and the support for the arts and certainly for music in this town has been exemplary as time has gone on and things have developed, you know. I'd say probably the one that stands out the most to me is, you know, 142 Throckmorton Theater and what Lucy Mercer and Danny Slomov have done. Sacrificed of themselves just to have an amazing art space in our community. That was, you know, it's an old movie theater and Oddfellows Hall and has amazing acoustics. And Steve Coleman, the resident artist who has turned it into the Sistine Chapel, you know, and I just think that's an amazing thing. It's the level of artistry and the kind of people that you can go to see in downtown Mill Valley. Between what they're doing at 142 Throckmorton and, of course, the new Sweetwater, it's just incredible. I find myself, you know, sitting at home saying, all I have to do is go to the center of my hometown to see this amazing music. Mm-hmm. And that's just phenomenal.
Yes, but you're involved, aren't you, at the Throckmorton? I mean, after today's interview, you're going to be heading over there.
That's right. That's right. I came to Lucy about a year ago and proposed doing a songwriter circle. So I actually use one of the front rooms, the Tivoli room, holds about 40 people. Steve has turned it into something that looks like it's in Versailles or the movie Barry Lyndon or something. It's this amazing room with perfect acoustics. We play a really intimate thing with three or four songwriters at a time. I've done that. I've hosted. I've helped stage manage a kiddo, you know, school benefits there. I've performed there a number of times and for a number of things. And it's just an amazing asset. It's an amazing space, I stay as involved with it as I possibly can. Played their New Year's Eve. I mean, I do all kinds of things there. And same with the Sweetwater. When I get the call, I've played outside, and I've played on the main stage a number of times, done different nights there, and that's another real joy. I haven't been involved with Django Fest at both places. Have nothing but good things to say about what goes on in those places.
And I have to say, especially thank you for the last-minute calls I've given to you to help augment the First Wednesday Speaker Series when we'd like to add a little music to after the show or during the presentation.
Well, that's a joy. And Mill Valley Library, what an amazing building and a beautiful place to play. And, you know, another incredible resource in this town that, you know,
I'm never in enough. You know, I wish it was down the street from me. As far as where I live in town, I'd be there all the time.
If you could switch one thing in Mill Valley right now, if you could hearken back to another time, if you could tell people about Mill Valley that you feel is slipping away, or from a Mill Valley that you highly identified with, what would that be?
Well, I think the traffic is endemic of that. The place I first came to was a sleepy little not quite bedroom community, and that suited me just fine. You know, there was an ability to breathe a little, mm-hmm. and live life a certain way and not have to be scrambling mm-hmm. every minute of every day to pay your rent or your mortgage mm-hmm. or whatever it is you have to pay. Mm-hmm. And if there was anything, I would go back to that in Mill Valley, in California in general. Every place I've lived has become that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it was nice to be able to just kind of roll on downtown and hang out, mm-hmm. go to the old mill, see what's going on, and eventually the Sweetwater, the original Sweetwater came around. And it was a low key place. Mm-hmm. It was a relaxed place, mm-hmm. and I think you talk to anyone who comes here from any place still, and it's still relaxed to them. Comparatively relaxed, yeah. You know. People I know who run businesses, own stores in San Francisco, and they say, yeah, Mill Valley is the one place I want to go and just hang because it's just this great atmosphere and all that. And it's true. The redwoods are still there. You know, the trees are still there. The buildings are still there. It's just become so dear to have to live here. I would like to see you go back to that little space between the 50s and the 90s where you could just kind of, you know, kick back a little bit and relax and live your life and not have to kill yourself and keep it going.
Yes. Amen to that. Well, perhaps it's something you can write a song about.
I've certainly touched on that in several of my songs. You know.
One of the reasons I really like the old railroad grade is it takes you back to another time.
Thank you.
And place, because Mill Valley was very different then to even the town that you lived in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And yet that song somehow or another, even though it's bluegrass and we're California, it really captures it. And I like that your band, Dory Collar and the Millbillies, are all local guys, performers as well, by the way.
Everyone but one. I tried as much as I could to fill all of the instrument spots with locals. Got close.
So before we end this interview, I would like to ask if you would consider playing that song.
Oh, I would consider it.
You sure, would? Deborah. Before we get to the song, which I'm excited to hear, because I probably only heard it 10,000 times, well, maybe 500 times, and I've never yet been tired of it. I always enjoy it. Let me ask you a couple questions. Is there anything in this conversation that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
Let's see. I haven't mentioned my grandchildren yet. Got to cover them. You know, there's Sonora, who's 6, and Julian, who's 4, and Stella, who's 1. They live in Southern California. Maybe we'll be able to afford to get them up here one day. Mm-hmm. And I really want to stress, you know, that I have music, and I feel incredibly, unbelievably lucky to have music. And it's really important to give back. You know, to make a commitment to the community in whatever way you can. You know, whether it's contributions or whatever, to give back what you have. You know, and share that is something I'd like to mention. You know, and I don't know. I mean, I've been around for a minute or two. I don't know if you want me to give any sort of advice or anything.
Advice is always welcome.
Shut up and pay attention. Be patient for the things you want. And always go for it. Always attempt, at least, to go for the things you think you want.
Sage advice.
Sounds like something you should say in an interview.
Well, I think you mean it.
It's how I live. It's how I try to live. I certainly am, I am a go-for-it kind of person when I have an idea. And, it's nothing ventured, nothing gained, you know?
Mm-hmm. Spoken as from the words of a man who explored the city at 14, wide open, ready to go.
Pretty mellow, wimpy place compared to Manhattan.
Yes, know, I suppose at so. At the time. Yes, you know, yeah.
It seemed like everybody was so nice. That's the other thing I will say. I'll give that as a maxim from all of my years of hitchhiking and traveling. If you allow a person to just be a decent person, 99% of the time, that's who they will be. If you give someone a chance to be decent, most of the time, that is going to be their first reaction.
True.
Enough maxims from me.
I enjoyed that one. So do you want to do a little time traveling right now? Shall we go back?
Might we play a little bit of the old railroad grade?
How about the whole thing?
Okay. I don't usually play it on this guitar, but I think the chords work out the same. Let's see here.
Blydell Canyon and around the Horseshoe Curve, running through the Redwood Forest, you could see from near to far. From the top of the world, you know just where you are. Riding on the mountain, trouble starts to fade. Heading through the Redwoods on that railroad grade. Now come on, darling, now they've made it safe. Let's head up the mountain, that railroad grade. Westport in, you could change two more lives. The ocean spur down to Willow Camp, you could run out on the beach. Oh, wait, every place you go, good times within reach. Up top was the old Tam Tavern, just below East Peak. You could sneak up for a quick one in the middle of the week. Have a drink or two, enjoy the view, you don't have to travel far. And then you roll back down on the gravity car, riding on the mountain. Trouble starts to fade. Heading through the Redwoods on that railroad train. Now come on, darling, got it made in the shade. Let's head up the mountain on that railroad train. Well, the year was 1900. Yeah, that was pretty clear. There was a terrible train wreck that killed the engineer. Well, it was halfway up the mountain before milepost number 5. Well, he hit the brakes, but he didn't come out alive. Well, his name was Ernest Thomas, in engine number 2. Well, to be filled up upon the tracks, there was nothing he could do. Well, the engine crashed way down the slope, it was such an awful scene. Well, he lost his life in a burst of steam. Riding on the mountain, trouble starts to fade. Heading through the Redwoods on that railroad grade. Now come on, darling, got it made in the shade. Let's head up the mountain on that railroad grade. Now all these long years later, when so much time has passed, well, these railroads turned to trail roads, people loving them to the last. And there's hikers and there's bikers, they all want to spend the day riding up and down that good old railroad grade. Riding on the mountain, trouble starts to fade. Heading through the Redwoods on that railroad grade. Now come on, darling, got it made in the shade. Let's head up the mountain on that railroad grade. Let's head up the mountain.
Very nice. What do you say, Dory? You got a little more music in you?
You want to hear another one?
I would.
It doesn't take much provocation to get me to play a little more music, so I think I can squeeze one more in here.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose I should, since this is an interview about the Mill Valley experience from my eyes, We should do the Mount Anthem, wouldn't you think?
I think so.
The way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I would love that.
Orchestra comes up here.
Okay. Curtain opens.
As it rises straight up from the sea, oh, we're gonna clean up the top of this mountain and put it back the way it's supposed to be. Oh, the first time I climbed the top of the mountain, I saw the snow-capped peak so far away. Oh, looking out across the bay and that great valley, well, that's a vision that I cherish to this day. And when you hike up the slopes of the mountain, in the sun, fog, or in a winter storm, you can feel its great spirit around you. You gotta keep it in its natural form. I'm looking up at this beautiful mountain as it rises straight up from the sea. Oh, we're gonna clean up the top of this mountain, put it back the way it's supposed to be. There was the time I gazed at the top of the mountain from a ship that was going off to war. When I returned, they had bulldozed the top off. The West Peak wasn't there anymore. Well, soldiers took over the mountain. Well, they did just what they pleased and had their way. And when they left, there was a big old mess to clean up. And that's why I'm talking to you today. 'Cause we're looking up at this beautiful mountain as it rises straight up from the sea. We're gonna clean up the top of this mountain, put it back the way it's supposed to be. Well, the first people considered her sacred. Tamalpais, a peak they so revered. And now her ridges are practically naked. The big trees have all but disappeared. It's up to us to watch over the mountain, fix it up, dig it and do our share, so we can save it for future generations, and they all get to breathe that sweet clean mountain air. Oh, we're looking up at this beautiful mountain as it rises straight up from the sea. Oh, we're gonna clean up the top of this mountain, put it back the way it's supposed to be. Oh, we're gonna clean up the top of this mountain,
put it back the way it's supposed to be. Dory, thank you so much for a delightful interview.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for asking me, Deborah.
I think I get my exit music here, right?
Exit music.
What do you think this is?
We're NPR.
Here we go. Let's do it. This is Deborah Schwartz and Dory Caller. Thank you so much for your time and your energy and all the effort that you give to our community and to our town. For the music that's in your heart and that you share with us all. And for capturing a time and a place for us here in Mill Valley. So I will say on behalf of Mill Valley Historical Society, this concludes your interview. Let's go outside and look at the mountain, shall we?